Revelation 21, familiar to many of us, but let's start reading. Let's start reading beginning in verse 1. When time ends, John says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth passed away, there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them. They shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning, or crying, or pain. First things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. And he said, Write, for these words are faithful and true. Then he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God. He will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, immoral persons, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars will find their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Then one of the angels, seven angels, who had the seven bowls full of seven last plagues, came and spoke with me, saying, Come here, and I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. And her brilliance was like a very costly stone. He goes on to describe at length what he sees. Drop down with me to verse 22. After he gets to describing the city he sees come down, it says, I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God the Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And the nations will walk by its light, and the kings of earth will bring their glory into it. In the daytime, for there will be no night there, its gates will never be closed. And they will bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And then he showed me a river, the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street, on either side there was the river. Of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. There will no longer be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his bondservants will serve him. And they will see his face. His name will be on their foreheads. And there will no longer be any night. They will have no need of the light of a lamp nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God will illumine them. And they will reign forever and ever. It's a familiar portrait, I think, to many of us at all, this picture of what happens at the end. We've been calling this series this week in the Lord of History. And so that what we're going to do is we're going to talk about how God wraps up history at the end, where the story ends. And part of what we want to understand this evening is, and by the way, you'll notice at the end of that language, as that scene ends, what's described there, the reign that comes to pass as God's people join him in reigning over creation. One of the things that is interesting that happens as God ties up history, as God brings his lordship of a history to its climax. Remember, I am the beginning, I am the end, I am the Alpha, I am the Omega. Part of what God is getting at there is a very real sense that we end, and history ends, in some sense where it began. One of the things that's easy to overlook or miss sometimes is just how thoroughly, number one, the Old Testament is represented here. New heavens and a new earth. Well, John didn't get that from scratch. That actually starts back in the book of Isaiah 65. Remember, we talked about this morning, Jesus' whole point was, it's all there in the prophets. It's all there in the Old Testament if you know where to look for it and you read it carefully. And so the idea of the Jerusalem as a bride, that's there in Isaiah. That God will dwell among his people, that's a common refrain in the Old Testament. It starts in Leviticus, goes all the way through, and of course finalizes itself in Revelation. That God will be with them. He will be their God. They will be his people. Again, all through the Old Testament. That God will wipe away tears and there will be no longer any death. That's in Isaiah. The end of pain, the former things passing away. Again, Isaiah 65 describes this. God makes all things new, Isaiah 43. That God is the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, Isaiah 44. God gives water of life to the thirsty, Isaiah 55. Isaiah factors large. And God basically saying, here's what I've said in the past, but now through Jesus, let me tell you exactly, even more so, what this looks like and where this is going. But in all this Old Testament imagery and language that John is actually using, that God is having John use, one of the most important things, Alpha and Omega, beginning and end, the end of history in some ways brings us back around to where we started in the first place, the paradise that was lost. Did you catch how much there was of Eden there in Revelation? In fact, if you have your Bible still, flip back to the other side of the Bible with me, Genesis chapter 2. When God first is making the creation over 6 days at the beginning. In John 6, beginning of, or Genesis 2, beginning of verse 8, the Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden. And there he placed the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight, good for food. The tree of life also was in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as well. Now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden. From there it divided and became four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon. It flows around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. The bdellium and onyx stone are there also. The name of the second river is Gihon. It flows around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Tigris. It flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates. And it's then that the Lord God took the man and put him in that garden to cultivate it. You notice here, and this is just a quick and easy reference for sake of time scene, but notice how the tree of life is where we begin and where we end. There's a river that flows through it. And ultimately, it's a region associated with the beauty of gold and gemstones. And if we were to read more closely that description of the city that John saw coming down, it would reflect very similarly the gold, the gemstones, all the precious stones that the city is built out of and walled with. In a lot of ways, we tend to end right where we began in biblical parlance. History comes to a close, comes full circle, because God will have what he always wanted, which is an unmediated relationship with the creature he made in his image. God will not be thwarted his eternal purpose. People can make their choice and go to hell, but God will not be thwarted. He will have a face-to-face relationship with the humans whom he has made. And that's part of why the Bible paints the portrait of the end of history in this way, to basically say that God's purpose has never been lost and God has never given up upon it. That we will, in a sense, end where we began, with God's purposes eternally accomplished. But what's interesting is, and part of why we call this like looking for a city, is that there has always been the city of God, which is what the New Jerusalem is that John sees coming down. But there has also been in the Bible another city, a rival city to God's eternal city, the place where he and man could dwell together, that partakes of these Edenic qualities. Remember in Genesis chapter 3 when the fall comes to pass. Remember in Genesis chapter 3, the beginning of verse 24, the text says that God drove the man out of the garden. And at the east of the Garden of Eden, he stationed the cherubim and the flaming sword, which turned every direction to guard the way to the tree of life. And so God basically begins by sending man to the east of Eden. And one thing I want you to think about, maybe you've never thought about this before, is the Bible is often very specific in the details that it gives. Kind of like we talked about last night with John's gospel a little bit. You know, you can read a gospel in 2 hours, yet Jesus' ministry lasting years. There's more that goes on than what we are told. So what we are told and the details that we are often given are often significant. We just tend to often sometimes miss in our reading what's given and how to connect the dots. One of the things that happens as man falls from God's fellowship because of sin is that man begins an eastward direction in Genesis that is repeated. The further man goes from God, from where he started. And so it starts here in Genesis 3 when man is first driven out, that at the east of the Garden of Eden is where the cherubim were stationed, as though the east side was the side perhaps of the entrance to the garden. But you remember what happens, of course, in the course of the story. By Genesis chapter 4, Cain takes the sin of mankind to another level as he murders his brother. And you remember in Genesis chapter 4, if you still have your Bible there, beginning in verse 11, when God comes to hold Cain accountable for murdering his brother. In Genesis 4 and verse 11, God tells Cain, "Now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground," because remember, Cain had been a farmer to this point, "when you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is too great to bear." What's his punishment? "No longer you can farm, you will be a wanderer for the rest of your life." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is too great to bear. Behold, you have driven me this day from the face of the ground, and from your face I will be hidden. I will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me." And so the Lord said to him,
Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain so that no one who found him would slay him. And so Cain goes out from the presence of the Lord. He settles in the land of Nod. Where? East of Eden. Cain had relations with his wife. She conceived. She gave birth to Enoch. And he built, now look at what he does. He built a city and called the name of the city Enoch, after the name of his son. And now that Enoch was born, Arad, and Arad became the father of Mahuhalel, and Mahuhalel became the father of Methushael, and Methushael became the father of Lamech, and Lamech took to himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, the name of the other was Zillah. And Adah gave birth to Jabal, and he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Ubal, and he was the father of all who play the lyre and the pipe. And as for Zillah, she gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. And Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech, give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, Lamech 77-fold. I want you to notice what happens now in the story of Cain and Cain's line. In a sense, the last thing that God says to Cain is that you are to be a wanderer. And yet, for the first time in human history, a city is built. A city is built. Who built the city? Cain did. But what was Cain supposed to be? He was supposed to be a wanderer. The first rival, that says, to the city, the dwelling of God, comes from Cain. The line of humanity in rebellion. Did you notice how as we go through Cain's line, the depravity spreads? By the time you get to the seventh generation, Lamech, what does he do? Lamech, one of Cain's descendant relatives, gives us two new innovations in human history according to Genesis. Bigamy, he's the first one with multiple wives. And somebody who now doesn't, who basically murders and boasts about it. Kill the lad for wounding me, for striking me, man. He wants to mess with me. I'll show you what it means. If you think messing with Cain will get you in trouble, mess with Lamech and see what happens. The spread of what by the beginning of Genesis 6 will be said to be violence over all the face of the earth. And it's tied to Cain's line. Because Cain's line represents human race and growing rebellion against God. They go east and they build cities. In direct violation of what God told Cain was his punishment. Cain was supposed to be a wanderer, and instead he founds the first city. And around Cain begins to develop the settled civilization of the city, metallurgy, arts, and things like that. If we had more time, we could go into Genesis chapter 5, and you could compare Cain's line with Seth's line, which is meant to be a direct contrast to Cain's line. Because it's in Seth's line that we find men calling upon the name of the Lord, Noah most notably. And it's the way the genealogies work is there's a comparison made because of Lamech and his bigamy and his boasting and murder is the seventh from Cain. The seventh from Seth and Adam is Enoch, who walked with God and was not because God took him. A comparison of two lines in the human race, those who call upon the name of the Lord and those who continue to rebel against God, moving to the east and building their cities. Well, of course, over time, what happens? Well, cities grow, and intermarriage leads to the violence, which leads to God cleansing the earth with the flood in the days of Noah. And after the reset of the flood, which is really what it is, God uncreates back to the waters in the firmament and recreates. The dry land gradually emerges, birds go out first, just like the fifth day, and finally land animals and man go back upon the earth. And in Genesis chapter 9, God even tells Noah, you're the new Adam, be fruitful and multiply, is what he's implying. And so after the reset of the flood, the chance for the human race to do over because the Cain line of Cain is wiped out in that flood, right? It's the line of Seth preserved through Noah. After the reset, we eventually come to the same place, Genesis chapter 11. In Genesis chapter 11, it's very interesting what happens here now. So after the reset of the human race, God's attempt, as it were, to again have people who fear him and call upon his name and serve him and walk with him. And Genesis chapter 11, beginning in verse 1, now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. You know this story. Came about as they journeyed. Oh, which direction was the human race moving again? They were moving to the east. You never want to move to the east in Genesis. It always brings bad things. That they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. They said to one another, come, let's make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone. They used tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves. Wait for it. What is it? A city. The first city after the fall was founded by Cain in rebellion. The next city after the flood that is founded is once again founded in rebellion. Because what were they supposed to do? They were supposed to, as they say, build a tower, reach in the heaven, make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be what? Scattered over the face of the earth. They didn't want to do what Cain was supposed to do either, which is to spread themselves and fill the earth and subdue it. And so the Lord came down to see the city that the sons of men had built. The Lord said, behold, they're one people. They all have the same language. And this is what they begin to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. So come, let us go down, confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. And so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth. And they stopped building the city. And therefore its name was called Babel. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. In Hebrew, Babel is spelled the same way throughout the entire Bible, so that Babel literally becomes Babylon later. It's all spelled the same in Hebrew. Babylon becomes the quintessential city of man. Men founding their own attempt at civilization, their own way of living in creation, despite what their creator wants. Cain founded the first city. Babel is the next city after the flood, after the human race starts over again. And so it becomes all the more telling that this time what happens is rather than Genesis 11 sending another flood because of human rebellion, remember God's promised, in fact, he won't do that again. What does God do? Well, he starts a different kind of renewal program. In Genesis chapter 11, that same chapter, dropping down to verse 27, what does God do? Now these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abram his son, Lot the son of Haran his grandson, Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. They went as far as the city of Haran, and they stopped. They settled in the city of Haran. Days of Terah were 205 years. Terah died in Haran. And so once Terah was dead, having settled in Haran and stopped the journey to Canaan, God comes in 12:1 to Abram and says, go forth from your country, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And so what happens then is God calls Abraham out of the cities and sends him back. And here's the interesting thing is the direction in which God sends him. If mankind's path of rebellion has been continually to the east in Genesis, God sends Abraham back to the west from Ur to Haran to the promised land. He reverses literally the direction of human migration with Abram, calls him, points him literally in a different direction. To this point. And so they leave Ur, the region of the world in which Babylon is, for Canaan. They almost didn't finish the journey. They stopped in Haran, but Terah dies and God has Abram finish the journey. And so Genesis 12 and verse 4, Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarah, his wife, Lot, his nephew, all their possessions they had accumulated, persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and thus they came to the land of Canaan. And here's what's important biblically speaking then. Abram never lived in a city or a house again in the rest of his life. He left the quintessential city of man behind. And that was part of what made Abraham such a great man of faith. He left the human project, the human attempt at civilization and creation without God. And he left it behind. God called him from the civilized part of the world to the wild part of the world. He called him from the east back to the west. He called them out of the city. And Abram never lived in a city or a house again. In fact, it's really interesting as the story goes on in Genesis, then when you stop and think about it, when does Lot begin to get in trouble? When he moves from where? From where Abraham is to where? He pitches his tent toward Sodom. He pitches his tent toward Sodom. And if we had time, we could go through Lot's own story in Genesis. And it's interesting to watch the evolution of Lot's location in the story. Lot begins by pitching his tent toward Sodom. Eventually, Lot lives in Sodom in a house. Eventually, you find Lot in the gate of Sodom. That is, we go from outside the city, but getting closer to it, to inside the city, to in the gate of the city, which is basically being one of the leaders of the city. And then eventually, he hesitates to leave the city when once again called out of it, to the great detriment of his own family. and has to be forcibly removed by the angels. This is why the Hebrew writer who understands this writes this way in Hebrews 11, beginning of verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. Why did he do that? Because he was looking for a city. Well, they had cities, but they were man-made cities. They weren't the city of God. And so he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, because she was considered faithful to him who promised. Therefore, there was born, even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and as numerable as the sand which is by the seashore. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles in the earth, because those who say such things make it clear that they're looking for a city, a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of the country from which they had come, they could have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, because he has prepared a city for them. And so what the Hebrew writer is doing is he's just basically going back and he's basically saying, read Genesis carefully. This is what's really going on. It's the struggle. It's the story of two cities, a tale of two cities. The city of God and the city of man. The city of man can take many forms over the course of history. But it's always a struggle with who, where are you going to live and whose culture, whose values are you going to live by? The first city on earth was built in rebellion. The city after the flood was built out of rebellion. And even to this day, think about in our own politics, in our own culture, in our own country. Do we not sit there and basically talk about rural values versus city values? And generally we talk about, you know, where are we even demographically, where do more conservative people tend to be found? In the less urbanized states, what the elites condescendingly call flyover country? There's always been a tension between the life of the country, the undeveloped, and the city of man. And you still see it in all sorts of ways to this day. And so Babylon then becomes the quintessential city of man. But here's what's really interesting then. Here's what's really interesting about all of that is then when we begin to think about the alternative. Man is, in a sense, the first one to build the city. What did God make for man to dwell in when God was working creation? Well, he made a garden. He provided Eden as a place of provision and a place of fellowship between God and his people. The Lord planted a garden toward the east in Eden. And there the man whom he had formed, he placed there. And we've read about what God did and how wonderful it was, the trees, the rivers, the gold. And in Genesis 2 and verse 15, it says that God put man in the garden to cultivate it and to keep it. But man lost the garden. And man lost the face of God. And so what happens? How does man find his way back to God's presence? Well, here's what begins to happen, is you go to Mount Sinai. And when you go to Mount Sinai, you find out this, Exodus 19, beginning in verse 12, that you will set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you don't go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. And so God comes down and meets with Moses on Sinai. And when they get to the end of the making of the covenant, God in Exodus 24 says this. He says to Moses, come up the mountain to the Lord. You, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, 70 elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord. In other words, go up to the top of the mountain. But they did not come near, nor shall the people come up with them. And so Moses went up on the mountain with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. This is a place where God and people could meet, on Sinai. They saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles and sons of Israel. They saw God, and they ate and they drank. And then God told Moses, now to come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I'll give you stone tablets. And so on and so forth. And so Moses goes up on the mountain to the mountaintop in the story. And what we begin to see is God beginning to reestablish his relationship, a way and a place in which people could come and find God and worship with him. And so what happens on Sinai is, if you look at Exodus carefully, you have Sinai divided into three zones. You have around the mountain where nobody else could come up. The common people had to stay down. Anybody starts to come up the mountain, they're killed. But then God makes an exception. Moses, the guys who will become the priests, and the 70 elders of Israel are allowed to come up partially on the mountain where they will meet with God and eat a fellowship meal to celebrate the making of the covenant. But only Moses is allowed to go up to the top. You know what you just had there? You've had three zones created. The mountain around which Israel camps, and you can see and know that God is there. On the mountain, where select few can come, and the top of the mountain where Moses alone goes. You know what you have? You have the three parts of the temple, the three parts of the tabernacle there. You have a courtyard where others can come and worship God at the, in a sense, the base of the mountain. You have the holy place where the priests can go, the select few, and you have the most holy place where only God's one lone representative can go. When God then has Israel build a tabernacle, later a temple, he's basically recreating the hierarchy about how you find your way back to God that was established on Sinai. But it's interesting that so when God tells them then to build the tabernacle, as Exodus continues, it's very interesting what we find out happening. You remember in Genesis it says that when man was banned from God's presence, God placed a cherubim. Cherubim, we usually say angels, but the Bible's more specific about that. It was cherubim who were placed there. Well, what happens when God tells them to make the furnishings and the curtains of the tabernacle? In Exodus 26, we're told that they were going to make for the tabernacle 10 curtains with fine twisted linen, blue, purple, scarlet, and he shall make in these, wave into these curtains, cherubim, the guardians of God's presence is what they are. In Exodus 26, beginning of verse 31, you shall make a veil of blue, purple, and scarlet material, fine twisted linen, and it shall be made with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. You'll hang it on four pillars of acacia overlaid with gold, their hooks and so forth. And you shall hang it up, the veil under the clasps, and you shall bring in the ark of testimony there within the veil. And the veil shall serve for you as a partition between the holy place and the holy of holies. And so literally what happens is, we often don't think about the visuals of the tabernacle, and this is going to carry on to the temple. It's a cloud of cherubim, of the angels that guard and protect God's presence from those who have no business being there. To enter into God's presence is to go before the angels of heaven. And God's presence, just like God left cherubim to guard and keep man from going into the garden any longer, God basically places cherubim all along the way that man has to get past, as it were, to see his presence in the most holy place. In fact, to that end, do you remember then what actually sits on the Ark of the Covenant itself? Two cherubim. Eventually what happens is when they build the temple, 1 Kings chapter 6, the imagery gets even more elaborate. Not only now that we have a cloud of cherubim, the angelic beings that protect the presence of God from sinful man who has no business being there. But in 1 Kings chapter 6, beginning in verse 23, when they were able to build a more solid structure, a more permanent structure, here's how the imagery changes a little bit. In the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, 10 cubits high. In other words, in the most holy place, they made two giant cherubim that hang over the ark itself. But when we drop down to verse 28, they overlay the cherubim with gold. Then verse 29, here's where it gets interesting now. They carved the walls of the house, of the temple. They carved the walls of the house round about with engraved carvings of what? Of cherubim, but not just cherubim this time. Look at what they engrave in the walls. Now that it's a permanent structure, we get more elaborate. With palm trees, open flowers, inner and outer sanctuaries. They overlaid the floor of the house with gold. Streets of gold, anybody? Inner and outer sanctuaries. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary, he made the doors of olive wood, the lintel and five-sided doorposts. He made two doors of olive wood, and he carved on them carvings of cherubim, palm trees, open flowers, overlaid them with gold, and he spread the gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. And so also he made for the entrance the nave, four-sided doorposts of olive wood, two doors of cypress wood, two leaves, one door of the one door turning on pivots, and the two leaves of the other door turning on pivots, and he carved on them cherubim, palm trees, open flowers, and he overlaid them with gold, applied on all the engraved work. Why are there so many trees carved in the temple walls and the temple doors? Because it's the garden. Because it's the place where God originally met with man. Because it's still guarded by cherubim. Because you can only come back there with blood when you're supposed to be back there. But God has them. We often don't think about the visuals. We just think about the temple's done and gone. We don't think about the visuals of what God was saying. What he was saying is, you still find me in the garden. My goal has never changed. You still find me by coming back to the garden. And so then it's really no wonder. It's the wonder that when we get to the city of God in the book of Revelation, when John sees it coming down, what does John see? He sees the true city. Man tried to build a counterfeit city throughout human history. But he sees the true city coming down. And in that city is the garden where God and man used to dwell together. Why don't we need a temple? Because there's no need to keep barriers between God and man anymore. God himself is the temple. You can see his face now. We're back in the garden. The tree of life is there. Leaves with healing for the nations. What happens when you see the city of God at the end? When history comes around full circle, you wind up back where you began. With not only the garden that God originally offered man, so to speak, the tree of life, but with the city enclosing it. The civilization, the security, the stability, the pride that man always tried to usurp in building their own cities. God establishes. And God provides. God ultimately provides the city that all men have been seeking since the earliest days after the fall. The story of the human race, history at the 30,000 foot level, is human counterfeits. Counterfeit cities, counterfeit kingdoms, counterfeit kings who claim to be gods. And to be able to do whatever they want with their subjects and with reality. Versus the true city of God where the king alone dwells. And offers the city that all men seek to his people who will come to him on his terms, his way, under his rule. And so the very real sense of what God does at the end of history is he merges two very different visions or strategies for human life into one perfect reality. His original garden with what human beings were questing for and building their own cities. Security, stability, prosperity, civilization, art, technology. He brings it all together in the end and gives us what we've always really wanted but will never be able to provide for ourselves. In his own time, in his own way, he offers us his own dwelling. And so to make it personal, and to bring it to an end then, 1 Peter is still apropos. We talked about this a little bit this morning, but it's amazing how thoroughly Peter, what he does throughout the entire course of his book. He begins in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 1 and verse 2. It says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens. Addresses the book to those who understand that we are not citizens of the city of man. Whatever name of the city we live in, whatever name of the nation we reside in. We are aliens, scattered throughout the world. 1 Peter 1, beginning in verse 14. As obedient children, don't be conformed to the former lust that you were in your ignorance. Rather, verse 17, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on the earth. You're just a sojourner in a strange place. 1 Peter 2, verses 11 and 12, we read that this morning. I urge you as aliens and sojourners to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. And then you get to the end of the book, 1 Peter 5 and verse 13, and Peter ends the book this way, very interestingly. She who is in Babylon greets you, he says. She who is in Babylon greets you. Was Peter in Babylon when he wrote 1 Peter? He was in Rome. Modern day Babylon for his era. The greatest city of the world at that time, full of all the pride, the arrogance, and the wickedness that the human race could muster in that era. See, Peter was reading the Bible the same way we've been suggesting tonight. It's always Babylon out there. It's always Babylon. It's always the city of man versus God's people waiting for the city of God to show up. Will we live like Abraham, in a sense, going out, maybe not literally out of Dallas or Arlington, but going out from the culture and from the ways of man to wait in tents, purposefully in some ways even impoverishing ourselves, certainly foregoing some of the options and opportunities that life could offer us in the city. Because like Abraham of old, we've learned the lesson, it's time to get out. Don't be the fool like Lot and go back. Pay a heavy price. She who is in Babylon, Peter says, because it's always Babylon. There's always the city of man out there. Or ultimately, as the Hebrew writer put it, as we read a little bit earlier, these all died in faith without receiving the promises, but they saw them. They welcomed them from a distance, having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. They confessed. Those who find the heavenly city confess that they're strangers, they're exiles. They live this way, they think this way. It becomes their worldview. Outsiders. Even if you have a house in a nice neighborhood with a good zip code, at the end of the day, you know who you really are and that you're not from here. For those who say such things, that they're strangers and exiles, they make it clear that they're seeking a country of their own. If indeed they've been thinking of that country from which they had gone out, they could have returned. But they want a better country. We want a better city. A heavenly one. And so God is not ashamed to be called their God because he has prepared a city for them. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. History in a nutshell. God's going to bring it back full circle, get what he always wanted, what he always intended. Going to reestablish face-to-face fellowship with humanity in a garden, so to speak, encased in a city, giving human beings what they tried to grab and usurp for themselves, failing to live in creation and live their lives the way God asked them to. And that's how history works. Full circle, back to the future, Alpha and Omega, beginning and the end. God always wins in the end. He'll bring history to its closing purpose, accomplish his eternal purpose, and separate the sheep from the goats. And the only question that really remains this evening is, which are you? Are you on the right hand or are you on the left? Are you going east or are you going west? Where will God place you when he judges in the last day? Depart from me, I never knew you, or well done, good and faithful servant.